Thank you, Henry Mancini. It's Sunday night, and that means from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening. This is John McMullen, John Mack to some. Welcome to the 162nd episode of the John Mack Radio Show. The recording for the previous 161 shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com, and John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C. So that's www.johnmack13.com, and they're on the radio show tab. My most recent and last piece for the West of the Guardian, the 212th article, is still available at that website, www.westofthegardian.com. And West of the Guardian is WestofTheGuardian, westoftheguardian.com. It's the last of the Creative Disruption series in the paper, as after the September 29th issue of the paper, The West of the Guardian has joined the likes of the New York Herald Tribune, the Washington Star, the New York Journal of America, and the Brooklyn Eagle in the graveyard of newspapers. In addition to the radio shows, you'll also find links to my online daily newspaper at my web home. Of the newspaper, there's a curation of news articles from around the country and the world, articles relating to politics, sports, books, the environment, arts and entertainment, opinion, and technology. But the real focus after this election's over on artificial intelligence, machine learning, big data, and what lies ahead. Try to subscribe only one email per day. And once again, that's at www.johnmack13.com. I hope you'll join us every week at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Sunday evenings, live or as most do, to listen later. Notifications of the most recent shows are sent out weekly by email and on Facebook. I hope you'll join us once again next week and every week. Then on to this show, the 162nd in the series, as I mentioned. Callers may call in at any time during the show by dialing 646-716-9756. That's 646-716-9756. I usually hold callers until near the end of my interview with my guest. My guest tonight is journalist, Pulitzer Prize winner, college professor, and memoir author, Paul Brinkley Rogers. We'll talk about his impressive background and long body of work in a freewheeling conversation tonight. But I met, if met is the appropriate word, Paul, when his book and story were recommended to me by the former guest, Lorraine Cipriano. In talking to Paul, it turned out that he and my oldest friend, Kevin Buckley, worked together over 40 years ago. So we have a double connection. So let's get started. Good evening. Welcome to the show, Paul.
Good evening. Good evening, John. Good to talk to you. Good to meet you. It's still bright sunshine here in Arizona where I live. But there I know it's probably night.
It is dark here now at the moment. So let's go back and start at the very beginning. Where did you grow up and go to early school?
Well, I grew up in England. I'm British born to British parents. In the late 1950s, my family emigrated to this country. My dad was an engineer. My mother was a homemaker. And I went to 1 year of American high school, wondered what to do with myself. Neither of my parents had been to college. And I chose out of desperation, I guess, to enlist in the U.S. Navy for 4 years. In those days, it was possible for young foreigners to enlist in the U.S. Armed Forces. And this slightly speeded up my acquisition of citizenship. It got me a green card, too. I did four years in the U.S. Navy. When I got out, won a National Defense Foreign Language Fellowship to study Japanese language.
Normally, I would go through the guest's career before getting into a discussion of any recent books, but the memoir, Please Enjoy Your Happiness, deals but the time before you really had a career. And if it weren't for the story depicted in the book, you might never have had the career which you did. Is that a fair statement, by the way?
Yes, it is. It's probably true. Probably true.
I want people to buy the book. So even though I'd like you to tell us all about it, I want the audience to understand that it's beautifully written and deserve your time, even if you get the story here. Having said that, Paul, please tell us the story.
Well, it's about myself at the age of 19, going on 20, seaman aboard the USS Shangri-La, which was an attack aircraft carrier. It made a Pacific cruise. The first foreign port of call was Yokosuka, Japan. And there, on the first night ashore, I met a remarkable woman, older than me. She was probably around 31, who basically took me under her wing, encouraged me to read and write. Told me to be a good boy, to study hard, not get into trouble, go to college. Very forceful woman who did not fit the usual stereotype of the Japanese woman, which is quiet, submissive, flowery, not authoritative. This is a very authoritative woman with a very tragic and unusual background.
What was the background, Paul, that was unusual?
She was not born in Japan, first of all. She was born in Manchuria, which in the 1930s and 40s was a Japanese colony in northern China, a very huge area, larger than Texas. And her family had emigrated there. Her dad was actually in the Japanese military secret police. He was a pianist also. She was born and raised in the city of Harbin, North China, which itself was extremely unusual. It had sometimes referred to as the Paris of the Orient. It was a very international city. Many European Jews lived there. There was a large Polish emigre community, a large white Russian community. She went to school with Russian and Jewish kids. As a teenager, she was already fluent in not only in Japanese, but Mandarin Chinese, Russian, and her English was quickly improving. She was very much unlike the typical Japanese who did not have a good command of English. She felt quite comfortable around foreigners in an international setting. And like myself, she was an outsider. I was an outsider in the United States as a young immigrant, and doubly so in Japan. And she herself, she managed to get back to Japan after members of her family were killed in Manchuria at the end of the war. But in Japan, too, she was a stranger, an outsider, foreign-born, and somewhat scorned.
Were her parents killed by the Chinese when the Chinese took the area back, or was this something else related to her parents' death?
Well, her father and two of her brothers were killed during their attempt to get out of northern China to find a ship to get back to Japan. Her mother died later of tuberculosis. And, you know, there are bits and pieces of this woman's history. Her first name was Yukiko, that I am not totally clear about myself because, again, I was just a young kid. I didn't have a journalist frame of mind then. I didn't think of asking all the appropriate questions. So I just got bits and pieces. Through research online, I was able to flesh out her story so much better than I had known it in the past.
Well, in the beginning of the book, when you talked about her story, I had the impression, and perhaps I'm wrong, that she did go through some period that she was a kept woman. Is that true?
That's true. Although, again, in my friendship with her, I really didn't know that until about halfway through the summer that I knew her, when there was an attempt by a Japanese gangster boyfriend of hers to kidnap her and take her back to the city where she had been used as a prostitute, actually.
Now, you mentioned everything that she had done for you, and I've been through the book, and yes, it was terrific, but you also had the marked influence on her life. Didn't you save her from the suicide attempt also?
That's true. That actually happened very early on in our friendship. And also, I think my role that summer was to be kind of a pleasant, intelligent young man who she could encourage to get an education, who would not abuse her. I think every relationship she had had up until then was abusive and violent. In my case, I was a young kid who walked around carrying books of poetry, very unsure of myself, in need of lots of guidance.
That must have been horrifying for you. Would you describe the circumstances of the suicide attempt?
Yes. I was aware, again, in that first week that I knew her, that she was desperately unhappy. As it turned out, her daughter had just died of tuberculosis that the daughter contracted from Yukiko's mother. And I went to the nightclub where Yukiko worked as a hostess, pouring beer for sailors. And they told me she had taken a few days off, and they told me where to find her, as they were aware of our friendship. And I went in there, went into the small hotel up a dead-end street. They told me which room she was in. I walked in, and she was lying on the floor, blood everywhere, very pale, but still alive.
How did you get her to the appropriate hospital or for medical care or to whatever to keep her alive?
Well, first of all, she slashed her wrists, and I tried to stop the bleeding by tearing up a bed sheet. But in the meantime, the hotel clerk had called the Japanese police. They arrived and took charge of the situation. And that's where I had my first encounter with this very unusual Japanese police detective, Goro Nozaka, who, strangely enough, had also been born and raised in Manchuria, like Yukiko. And because of that fact, understood her situation very well and took an active interest in her situation and in her fate, and also in the friendship that she and I had. He was a figure who constantly turned up at various situations that summer. All of that is detailed in the book.
Now, she must have been obviously very, very depressed to do that, but then she went on for years writing back and forth to you and occasionally seeing you. To what got her out of the deep depression? To what turned her around to continue her life?
Well, first of all, the letter writing that we did was just that summer.
Oh, okay.
At the end of the summer, when my ship left to return to the United States, I don't want to give too much away about the ending of the book, but it came to an end for various reasons. But you would have to buy the book and read it to understand why. But what enabled her to come back, I think, was this unlikely friendship that she had formed with me, and the delight that I was taking in her attempts to get me to read literature. We spent a summer watching wonderful Japanese films. It was kind of like the golden age of Japanese cinema, black and white, early Kurosawa films. And she was determined that I would see this with her. All the conversations that we had that I guess she found uplifting and helpful. And again, this relationship, this friendship that went on during the summer that did not abuse her whatsoever.
Now you edited her letters for English and you sent them back to her. So she was getting something in return in the friendship. Exactly what did she encourage you to do that you hadn't thought of doing before or that you weren't planning to do before you met her?
Right. Well, you know, very early in her letter writing, she started expressing her opinion that I would write a book one day, which, again, to a 19-year-old kid was astonishing that an adult would, first of all, tell him that, and secondly, see something in him that would cause her to have that opinion. She expressed that thought several times in her letters. She looked to the future and said that one day she would hear about me, that I could become a journalist. She said it's not as great as being a poet. It's sort of a side pocket of culture, but you probably would do very well there. She made all these predictions, which at the time seemed to be astounding, astonishing, crazy. But she was right on in terms of what she saw as my future.
We have many things to get to in your history as a journalist and everything. But one question that I plan to ask till the end of our interview that comes to mind, since she talked about you writing a book, most journalists who have the book in them, they're writing along the way, and certainly you had experiences that you could have written about. What took you almost 60 years to, or 55 years to finally write a book, particularly a book about your correspondence with her?
It all happened really when I got into my 70s. My working career as a journalist had come to an end. I last worked for the Miami Herald out of Miami, Florida. I had a wonderful time there as the oldest reporter on their staff, covering Cuba and Latin America mostly. I also worked for about 5 years, I guess, for the local Spanish language newspaper here in Phoenix, La Voz, The Voice, and also worked for the Raza Development Fund, which is kind of like the bank for the National Council of La Raza, the Latino Civil Rights Organization. But I sort of wondered about my future. By then I was sort of in my mid-70s, approaching my mid-70s, and I started traveling to Costa Rica in Central America on a regular basis, and there formed friendships with a group of older Americans and Europeans. We would quite often sit around a table late in the afternoon or during the evening, drinking beer, smoking cigars, and talking. And among men of that age, typically, a lot of the conversation turns to women that we knew in our youth.
And that got you started. All right, let me take you back to your career. Then once you were back in the U.S., as you mentioned, you embarked on a formal education, and you mentioned the scholarship. Was any also covered by the GI Bill as a result of your Navy service?
Yes. I won a National Defense Foreign Language Scholarship. That certainly came out of the military experience. And there were other benefits that came to me because of that, too. Some of the early requirements as an undergrad, first-year requirements, they were waived because of my military experience, which was nice, so I could quickly get into academic studies. And I was able to sort of partly finance my education at the University of Illinois by working part-time and then again almost full-time for a local newspaper in Champaign-Urbana, Illinois. One summer, met by chance a bureau chief, the Chicago bureau chief for Newsweek magazine, who recruited me shortly thereafter for a summer training program that the magazine had in Chicago. We're talking Chicago, 1966, Martin Luther King's open housing marches, the summer that the south side of Chicago went up in flames. It was a great time to be a trainee for a major magazine.
The University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana was just 6-7 years later where the first web browser came from that wound up putting computers into every home in the country. The first spreadsheet that put them into every office, VisiCalc, and the first browser was the thing that got everyone going. So there's a rich history there. Then you got into grad school, doing back to school after working for Newsweek for the summer.
Before that Newsweek experience, summer of 66, again, I was unsure what to do with myself, and I also won a Woodrow Wilson fellowship, and also won a scholarship from Harvard to study ancient Japanese history. So I was torn in two directions. Should I go into journalism, because I had this offer from Newsweek, or should I become an academic? When I talked to Newsweek, they said, well, you know, if you go to Harvard, you'll probably end up writing two or three very obscure books about ancient Japanese history that hardly anybody ever reads. But if you come to work for us, you know, there could be fame and glory and lots of wonderful adventures. And actually, that summer that I went to work for them began in a really strange way, too, because when I went to Chicago from Champaign-Urbana to do the interview for them, to see if I would make a good trainee, sitting in Newsweek's bureau was Ben Bradley, chief of the Washington Post, who also talked to me just in the lobby, and then a couple of days later called me up in my apartment and offered me the same sort of training job at the Washington Post.
Wow. And that was before you went to Columbia then?
That is, yeah. So what happened was I made the decision then to go to do the summer training program with Newsweek. It went very well. They wanted me to come to work for them right away. And I said, no, I wanted to do a year of graduate school and go to journalism school at Columbia University, which everybody thought was the best one in the country. And that's what happened. I did the 1 year at Columbia, got the master's degree, went immediately to work for Newsweek in Boston, and which, again, great year to be there, the year of the draft card burnings and student unrest, march on the Pentagon, all of those things I was able to cover as a young reporter.
And then you spent a bunch of time in various Newsweek bureaus, and eventually off to Southeast Asia, where you crossed paths with my oldest friend. Tell us about both your Newsweek, your general Newsweek career to where you were, and then take us to Vietnam, please.
Right. Well, you know, the Newsweek, I think Newsweek hired me mostly because I was a quote-unquote Asia specialist. I had Japanese language. I had some experience in Japan. And I actually ended up going to Vietnam for the magazine after one of their staff members was killed in Vietnam. And they must have had a conversation back there in New York City, something like, oh, who should we send to replace that guy? And they said, well, send Paul. He speaks Japanese. Of course, not knowing, typically like any New Yorker would, I guess, that they don't speak Japanese in Vietnam. They speak Vietnamese. Going to Vietnam was an unusual experience, too. My first wife, Kathleen, went with me. We spent a year and a half there on that first tour in Saigon for me, in an apartment in downtown Saigon. And during that experience, too, we also adopted our first child, a little Vietnamese girl who is now named Sarah and lives in Oceanside, California, and is in her early 40s. I also have two sons.
It was interesting. You mentioned Japanese. A friend of mine who I don't know if you've ever seen this, there's something on the internet called the longest beer run in history, and it was a fellow from the same Navy that Kevin and I came from, who was first a Marine, but then he was a Merchant Marine, and he was going to Saigon. People in the neighborhood said, buy a beer for the fellows over there. So he actually collected where they were, and he took over beer, and he hitchhiked through Japan, I mean to Vietnam, at doing actually stupid things because he was walking along roads where he wasn't sure who owned the road. But when he was in the Marine Corps, he had learned he was in Okinawa for 18 months, and he had learned Japanese there. And according to him, the hotels that he stayed at in Saigon were owned by Japanese, so he was able to converse with them. And he happened to be there, not that he wanted to be, for the Tet Offensive. He was there when they blew a hole in the side of the American embassy. So I'll send you I'll link to the video after the show.
That would be great. Yeah, he took a tremendous risk walking around Saigon, and as a young foreigner, I guess it's civilian clothes, right? Tremendous risk. He could have been shot dead easily.
But like Huey has a book coming out. He and Joanna Malloy, who used to write for New York Daily News, have a book that's been finished is in final editing about the whole experience. You mentioned your first time there. Did you leave then and go back?
There were, you know, various experiences and various assignments to the Newsweek Bureau in Hong Kong. That's during the Red Guard days. Mao was still alive. Several years in Japan with the magazine's Tokyo Bureau, writing about Japan and the Japanese economic miracle. A stint in Los Angeles covering Hollywood mostly, which I guess was sort of a reward for all the difficult war coverage that I've been doing. Back to Saigon and Phnom Penh, Cambodia in 1975 for the end of the fighting. I left Saigon before the fall of the city, a few weeks before that, and was sent to Phnom Penh, Cambodia, next door, and was airlifted out of Phnom Penh, courtesy of the U.S. Marine Corps, a helicopter, 4 days before the Khmer Rouge, the murderous Khmer Rouge, came to town to seize the capital.
When did you run across Kevin in your trips to that area?
First of all, in Saigon, when he was the deputy bureau chief there under Maynard Parker of Newsweek, who later on became chief of Newsweek in New York City, Kevin was the number two. I was the very junior member of the bureau. So a lot of the work I did for them was battle coverage. I didn't do the diplomatic scene so much like the other two guys were doing. But then again, later in 1975, in Phnom Penh, they had stationed Kevin there first. Then, when the North Vietnamese started pouring into South Vietnam in their major offensive to seize the entire country and liberate Saigon, they hauled Kevin back there to cover the drama of that and move me to Phnom Penh to cover that little but very nasty and brutal backwater of a war. I did that.
In your note to me, you also mentioned Korea, and this was something I'd forgotten about. The struggle between the dictatorship and the Catholic and Protestant churches. Now, I didn't realize there was an ongoing thing. Could you go into that a bit, the background on that, Paul?
Sure. Park Chung-hee was the former general who put on a business suit, I guess, to run a military dictatorship. The Catholic Church, one thing a lot of people don't realize about Koreans is that it's actually a goodly portion of the population there is Christian. They're either Protestants, Methodists, I think, or Catholics. And in the case of the Catholic Church, the bishop there, I forget his name now, opposed the military dictatorship because it ignored basic human rights. And the bishop defended those Korean intellectuals who dared to oppose Park Chung-hee, the dictator. The drama there that I got involved in was an assassination attempt by a Korean dissident on the life of Park Chung-hee in a theater where Park was addressing a very large audience. I was there listening to Park's speech. Park was on stage. Park's wife was seated very near the president. And suddenly there was the sound of a man running down the aisle, bang, 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 firing a pistol. One of the rounds hit the president's wife and killed her. The president's bodyguards ran onto the stage with 44 Magnum pistols and started shooting back at the man, which also meant shooting into the audience, killing several young Korean schoolgirls seated at the front. For some reason, although most people hit the dirt when the shooting started, I've never really been able to understand why. I stood up with an Asahi Pentax camera and shot photos of the guy running down the aisle and the exchange of gunfire. Those pictures were nominated for a Pulitzer and appeared on daily newspapers around the world. But then after that, of course, the Korean secret police tried to seize my film, but through various ruses, I was able to get the rolls of film over to the AP Bureau in Seoul to transmit to Tokyo.
Speaking of the Pulitzer, just last week, I appealed to Prize winner David K. Johnson, author of The Making of Donald Trump on this show. You were actually nominated four times for the prize before winning it in 2001. Maybe I should make the Pulitzer Prize our requirement for every guest on the show. Would you take us through the rest of your journalism career and be sure to dwell on both the nominations and the actual prize itself? You stayed with Newsweek for a while after
right,
that, right?
That's true. Until I think it was 1975, maybe 76. I left the magazine. I was in the process of getting divorced from my first wife. And actually, it's only in recent years since I've realized that after the whole Vietnam-Cambodia experience, I probably had a certain amount of post-traumatic stress, unlike the military, which had some rudimentary means of helping GIs with PTSD. At Newsweek and I guess all the other media outlets, there was no such program. You were encouraged, I guess, basically to tough it out if you had problems, drinking problems, marital problems, other problems. So my Newsweek, I quit, went to work for a newspaper in Idaho for a while where my first wife was living. That didn't work out. I wandered down to Arizona, bought an old house in the mining town of Bisbee, Arizona, on the Mexican border, and basically holed up there for 6 years, traveling in Mexico, studying Spanish. One thing I tried to do was develop an entirely new area of interest outside of Japan and Southeast Asia, because so many of my friends who had had that war experience were obsessing about it, and many of them, in fact, still do. I wanted to have an entirely new area of interest that I could leave that part of my past behind.
Well, that time when you were moving around and doing this, you also got nominated for another Pulitzer, didn't you, on the story about the shootout with the black church in Arizona?
That's true. That was a really tragic set of circumstances. A church, 100% African-American church, that had been based in Chicago, moved to a very small rural community in southern Arizona that had been the headquarters for Amy, what is her middle name? Semple McPherson, evangelist.
Sure.
And they took over her facilities. And, well, you can sort of imagine the rest, right? This is a church mostly of inner city and street people from Chicago, all black. Moved into a small Arizona rural community, all white, of no more than 200 or 300 people. There was just a different way of perceiving the world and the normal rules of behavior on the part of both groups of people. Soon there were incidents with sheriff's deputies, with local members of the resident population, and the sheriff's people were totally out of their depth. They had no experience in their lives with people from the south side of Chicago. They try to sort of get control of the situation eventually by attempting to serve various warrants on members of that black church, and in doing so, there was a fight that included gunplay on the part of both the sheriff's people and members of the church. And I witnessed that. I had actually a really good relationship with members of the church. Spent a lot of time sitting on their doorsteps, listening to their point of view and writing their side of the story. And I ended up sort of caught in the middle of the two warring parties. So that story was nominated for a Pulitzer.
That was when you were with the Arizona Daily Star. Are they still around?
Yeah.
Are they still around?
They're still around, the daily newspaper in Tucson. There was another Pulitzer nomination writing for the Phoenix newspaper, the Arizona Republic. I developed an interest in the Native American communities in Arizona and formed a pretty good working relationship with members of the Hopi tribe and the Navajo tribe up in northern Arizona, who are engaged in a big struggle over land. Very tragic set of circumstances. As a result of that, one day a Hopi elder who I knew told me that there was a crisis within that tribe of 10,000 people. Somebody had stolen some religious effigies. He was very circumspect about all of this at the beginning because it was sort of a taboo subject. But the tribe was desperate to get these effigies back because they were used in a crucial ceremony in which young male members of the tribe were given their adult male names. And without these effigies, that crucial ceremony could not happen. So they eventually, after many meetings, asked me if I would write about this issue that they faced. And that was a fabulous story involving art dealers who had participated in the theft, a group of young white kids in Arizona who had stolen these effigies and who then had to suffer in fear because the Hopi prophecies said that whoever had done this would die a horrible death. And indeed, several members of the group of thieves did die through various means before the mystery was solved. Unfortunately, the tribe didn't get back to the effigies, but they were able to modify the ceremony so that this name-giving ceremony could continue. And that story also was nominated for a Pulitzer because it had been so difficult to write, so difficult to get permission to give all the sides of the story.
You mentioned there was a struggle with the Hopi and the Navajo tribes over land. Was that between the two of them, or was that with them and the state or the federal government?
The federal government decided that that a group of Navajo, probably 5,000 or 6,000 people who were living on a certain portion of disputed land, had to move off there. The federal government decided that. And that land occupied by the Navajos for 200 or 300 years should be returned to the Hopi Nation. That's what that struggle was about. In those days, it was called the Big Mountain Struggle. And many Native American activists, including Russell Means and other people, congregated to the Big Mountain area, the disputed area, to lend support to the Navajos living there in their struggle with the federal government and with the Hopi tribe.
You also covered the... This copper mine strike, was that an Anaconda mine or was it a local mine?
That was the Phelps Dodge mine in Clifton, Morenci, Arizona. Again, a very famous, at least in the West, very famous labor dispute over wages and various other benefits with the Phelps Dodge Corporation. Bruce Babbitt, who later became Interior Minister, was governor of Arizona at the time, and he semi-militarized the Arizona State Highway Patrol to take control of the situation. There was a lot of physical violence. The Phelps Dodge Corporation brought in strike breakers to replace the striking labor, and the labor union lost. Again, a very tragic story.
Another story that you covered was, which I wasn't familiar with, and I'm the newspaper junkie. I'm constantly reading papers from around the country. But this the mass murder of Buddhist monks What was that all about?
Well, it's still somewhat of a mystery, actually. I at that time, I was working for the Arizona Republic as a reporter, and I had this this Asian background. It came up just as a normal matter of police news that there had been murders in a Buddhist temple on the west side of Phoenix. And I went out there, and somebody had killed, shot to death, 8 Buddhist monks who from Thailand who were residents at this temple, and it also had killed a couple of Buddhist nuns and I think a couple of other members of the Buddhist congregation, all Thai. The police were, again, out of their depth. They had no cultural awareness of Thailand or Buddhism. As I started reporting the story, one of the key police detectives actually would come to me to ask questions of me about the Buddhist faith and the sort of typical point of view that a Thai would have of such things as murder. The police were under a huge amount of pressure to solve the case. They arrested 4 or 5 young guys in Tucson, about 100 miles away, mostly because that group of young guys had a criminal record. One of them had been in the Phoenix area when they served search warrants on the houses of these young people. They found a little, what they thought was a statue of Buddha in one of the houses. So they arrest these guys. They interrogate them furiously for several days. The young guys confess to the murder. The police show me the statue of, they think it's the statue of Buddha. It's actually a little rotund statue of Hotai, the Chinese good luck god that you can see everywhere. It's always mistaken for a statue of Buddha. And I said, no, that's not Buddha. That's just a common good luck charm that you can find anywhere. Anyway, that case collapsed, and several weeks or maybe even months went by, and they finally accidentally pretty much apprehended a young Thai guy and a young Latino guy, I think, in a car who had rifles. They had rifles in the back of the car. And again, there was very high pressure interrogation. They got confessions of these kids. The case went to trial. But it was obviously, and I think they were found guilty, but there were problems. And even today, I think the case is still being appealed. There have been appeals, and then the appeals have been rejected, and more appeals. This is years after, and we're talking 15 or 20 years after the murders. This contest still goes on.
Wow. Ben, what took you from Phoenix to Miami?
My third wife, who was a newspaper editor, had been recruited by the newspaper in Fort Lauderdale, the Sun Sentinel. And she wanted to take the job. I was still working for the Republic in Phoenix. I applied at the Miami Herald. It seemed to be crazy because I was already into my 60s. Newspapers don't hire reporters in their 60s typically, but they hired me. And so that's why I went out there.
And that's where you actually won the Pulitzer as part of a team after the 4 nominations. Tell us about that story.
Yeah, it was, one of those team effort Pulitzers. So you may remember that there was a very interesting story about a young Cuban boy, Elian Gonzalez, who, with his mother and 5 or 6 other people, had been attempting to cross the Florida Strait from Cuba to find political asylum or whatever in this country. The boats ran into rough weather and sank. His mother placed the child, then 8 or 9 years old, in an inner tube. And although most of the adults on the boat drowned, including his mother, the young boy floated away on the inner tube and apparently was circled by porpoises who kind of acted as his guardians. Two Cuban-American guys who were out fishing came across the boy in the inner tube circled by the porpoises. And for them, this was kind of a recreation of the Cuban myth of the Virgin of the El Cobre, the patron saint of Cuba. A statue of that patron saint floated to Cuba on driftwood, circled by porpoises, too. They were convinced that this was some sort of religious phenomenon, I guess. So the boy, they brought the boy to Florida, where the boy had some relatives living. The relatives took the little boy in, and this began a huge custody battle between the boy's Cuban relatives in Miami and the boy's dad, who was not on that boat, back in Cuba. A huge custody battle that the United States government, of course, got involved in. The U.S. government spent months trying to decide what to do with the kid, whether they should return him. Janet Reno was the U.S. Attorney General at that time, and eventually she came down on the side of returning the boy to his parents. And there was a dramatic raid on the house of the relatives of Elian Gonzalez in Miami. Very famous photographs taken of an armed SWAT team member seizing the shrieking kid out of the arms of his relative. And I was a member of that team of reporters and photographers who had been tasked with covering the entire story from day one. And my job as a non-Latino pretty much was to go out into the Cuban community in Miami, get to know it, chronicle why the Cuban community felt so passionately about this child. I was there also for the end. I didn't witness the seizure of the kid, but did follow-up stories and also spent time for the newspaper traveling in and out of Cuba.
During the during your time in Miami, you had an opportunity to do some reporting from Argentina that also won you an award, and you also got involved in the Bush-Gore election and the arguments there. Could you take us through both those stories, the Argentinian and the?
Yeah. Again, you know, because of my background covering war, it materialized one evening in Miami in the newsroom of the Miami Herald that there was something going on in Buenos Aires. The presidential palace there, the Casa Rosada, was surrounded by demonstrators. People were beating pots and pans out into the streets. The president of Argentina, De La Rúa, had to flee the Casa Rosada by helicopter. Troops were being deployed in the streets. There was fighting starting. So the news editor of the newspaper told me, here's a guy booked to Buenos Aires, which I'd never been to. A plane leaves at 11 o'clock at night. It's like a 12-hour flight down there from Miami. Good luck. And I hit the ground running while I was there. This is around Christmas of 2001. While I was there, another president was named to replace the one who fled. And that president also was kicked out. Another president was put in there. This is all in the space of a couple of weeks. There was a lot of fighting in the streets. Police armed thugs who walked around with chains and baseball bats beating up demonstrators. Argentine-mounted cavalry were riding up and down in the streets, slashing at people with sabers.
Wow.
Little Argentine armored vehicles were zipping in and out of the streets, firing tear gas at people. It was quite an adventure. And for that, I won the Malcolm Forbes Award from the Overseas Press Club.
How long were you actually down in Buenos Aires?
I think that was probably no more than 3 weeks in Buenos Aires.
And what got you into the coverage of the Bush Gore brouhaha and the recount and the Pap, whether they wanted to vote for Pat Buchanan or for Al Gore? How'd you get into that?
Yeah, there's nothing. I didn't have any special role in that coverage. I was just a member of the group, member of the team, because it was an all-encompassing story. And as you remember, Florida was a pivotal state for both Bush and Gore.
They had the pivotal both, state.
Yeah, both teams, the pivotal state, right? Both teams had to win the state in order to win the election. And Florida had a mostly flawed system where these old-fashioned punch cards were fed through machines after you voted. The punch part of the process didn't always work, so that there was loose pieces of cardboard dangling from the card. This was a so-called Chad problem. And election officials had to sort of stare at these incomplete holes with magnifying glasses to figure out whether or not somebody had actually punched the hole or whether or not this was just some defectless. There were quite a few city photos, incredible photos taken of big-eyed officials trying to figure out what the heck had happened. And as you know, the whole thing ended up with the U.S. Supreme Court. The Bush camp claim victory, but I think there's still some pretty good questions to be asked there as to actually what happened and who won.
Unlike our present situation, you know, Gore handed over the thing and he said, okay, that's it.
Once the Supreme Court made its ruling, he acquiesced.
You were also still in Miami for 9/11. What was the coverage down there about this tragedy in both New York and in D.C.?
I didn't play any special role there. It was something that the entire news staff of the newspaper was involved in. You can imagine the scene in the newsroom there because the buildings, the twin towers, are not yet collapsed. We watched all of that, of course, on television monitors. The scene where the plane also hit the Pentagon. Nobody had any clue as to what the heck was going on, to what degree was the nation under attack. I was in the throes of a very desperate personal situation too. My third wife and I were getting divorced. She had just moved out. It was not the greatest time in my life. As a reporter, yeah, wonderful stuff to write about, but on a personal level, it was the pits.
There was something just yesterday on Facebook. There may have been a story out of a New York or a Washington paper that the Russians are threatening to release pictures that they have that prove that 9/11 was an inside job. I don't know that we're still debating this issue now, but I guess there are still some people that believe that.
Yeah, I'm no fan of conspiracy theories. Being a journalist, I need proof. And this has been a conspiracy theory that's been around from day one, and then I guess it gives certain kinds of people some sort of satisfaction that not all is right with the world. I think there's a group of people in this country who can only function in this world if they believe that every single demon you can think of is out there as their adversary.
Certainly, the Russians have shown that they'd be happy to disrupt our lives here right now. Then you moved into college teaching for a semester. What brought that on?
Again, not. I needed a stream of income. It just seemed to be something that I might enjoy, perhaps teaching young people. I taught English at the local community college, Mesa Community College, which actually is the biggest community college in this country. A huge place, and I had a lot of fun doing that. But it was just one of those positions where you're filling in for somebody on leave. So it was not a full-time job.
And I was at Ohio State, huh, for a semester.
Yeah, the same sort of thing at Ohio State. I worked there also briefly for the newspaper in Columbus, but that didn't go well. And again, various other, there were some personal issues going on with me and also with members of my extended family that caused that year that I was there to be very confused, very confusing. The actual class that I taught, it was in their journalism school, went very well. The kids voted me as their best professor that year in the J school, so that was very nice. But there were so many other personal things going on, and again, with members of my extended family, that caused my 1 year in Columbus not to be a happy one.
And
I left there. I left there for Arizona to come back to Arizona.
And then you came back to Arizona, and you also did some work with the Spanish language paper in Arizona, didn't you?
That's true. Yeah, that's coming back to Arizona was a good decision. Things started going well. I was introduced actually to the woman who was the managing editor of Lobos, a wonderful woman from Mexico City named Elvira Espinosa, and she liked the fact that I had reporting experience in Latin America and took me on there basically, well, number one, to write a column for them from a non-Latino point of view, but also to be a mentor to certain members of the staff. And all of that experience I enjoyed a huge amount. One of the young people that I mentioned, a young woman from Uruguay, Valeria Fernandez, went on to report for CNN and various other television networks. She did very well. So that was a very satisfying experience. And I actually won a prize from the Arizona Press Club for the best opinion writing in Spanish. No small achievement, right, for a non-Latino.
Right, wow. Yeah, I spent some time in Arizona. One of my favorite places in the world was Tombstone and the history there, and the fact there was a tombstone in the on Boot Hill saying, "Here lies somebody hanged by mistake." I thought that was pretty funny. And my wife and I. So go ahead.
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Tombstone is only about 15 miles from Bisbee, where I lived for 6 years, an old mining town.
Okay.
So I know Tombstone also very well.
And my wife and I spent some time both at conferences in Tucson and in Phoenix. And in Phoenix, for a couple of years, we were at the Tabasio, whatever. There was a couple of Tabasios there. And that was It's a very nice place. And the good friend of mine, Gail Thackeray, was the former assistant attorney general of the state. And the pseudo cousin, Amy McMullen, is a community activist in the Phoenix area. She's also the medical profession, as is her husband, Bob. And both Gail and Amy have been guests on the show. Have you ever crossed paths with either of them?
Well, that's interesting news. So you have a strong connection to Arizona in terms of both family and your own past experiences. That's good.
There's been talk of Arizona possibly being up for grabs in the presidential election. What does it look like to you?
Well, you know, I've been saying all summer long that I haven't seen any Trump or Clinton signs on the back of bumper, you know, car bumpers or truck bumpers or in people's yards. In the last month, there's been like an equal mix of both Clinton signs and Trump signs. I'm talking like very small numbers, no more than 10 of each, in sort of like the 6 or 8 block area surrounding my house. There's a great degree of interest in the contest, but I don't see too many people displaying their preference for the rest of the world to see. I think people are going to, you know, vote. I think most people have already made up their minds. And I do think that it's true from everything that I can sense here that Arizona could switch sides for the first time in many years. It could. Hillary could narrowly take the state. I think it's highly possible.
Are you willing to share your own preferences with the audience?
I made up my mind long ago. Long ago. From the very moment that the first Republican debates happened, when Trump, through being basically a water buffalo, puffed and huffed his way through the rest of the crew, it was pretty obvious that he was like a torpedo who would emerge as the Republican Party's candidate.
See, you also have been writing the column for a developmental fund. What's that all about?
Well, I was writing for the RASA Development Fund. It's it raises money for the National Council of La RASA. And it does such things as building community centers, supporting charter schools serving Latino kids, all kinds of other good works. But that work has come to an end.
Oh, okay.
Nowadays, because there's interest as a result of my first book, my first memoir, Please Enjoy Your Happiness, I'm now doing a second memoir that is set 10 years after the one that was just published. The new one deals with my adventures in Cambodia and Vietnam during the war. And I've also been working on a shorter piece of nonfiction. It looks at my experiences as a friend to a group of young gangster kids here in the city where I'm living, Mesa, Arizona.
Ah, that's interesting. And then how did that work out?
Well, I've got about 60 pages written. This is a mixed group of Latino and Anglo kids. In Arizona, we call kids who are whites basically Anglos. And they're involved in petty crime through a chance meeting with one member of the group. I struck up a friendship, was introduced in turn to other members of the group, met some of their parents also, and was able to sort of understand why that group of kids is on a dead-end street. No full-time, no work, no full-time job ever, quite often no ID card, all native-born, none of them immigrant children, but with no future other than petty crime. There's no school here, for example. The school that I taught at, Mesa Community College, does not offer anything to kids who don't have high school diplomas or GEDs. The East Valley Technical Institute, a trade school, a huge trade school here, you think they would offer courses to kids without high school diplomas, but no, they do not. So for kids in that category who can be bright, and in the case of some of the kids in that gang, can be fairly literate and actually write fairly literate English sentences with real punctuation, there is no opportunity for them other than perhaps the Job Corps, and space there, of course, is very limited. There are tens of thousands of kids like the ones in that group that I've become friendly with in this city. And if you suggest, for example, these kids that, oh, by the way, McDonald's has a help wanted sign in the window, they'll look at you and say, I wouldn't be caught dead working in a fast food store. There's no honor in it. Instead, they prefer to make money the way they know how, by small-time drug dealing, burglary, and in some cases, gun running to Mexico.
Well,
in that case, it's honor. And this is a group of kids who have known each other since grade school. So they literally, they're one large extended family. And the families that they come from, quite often the parents in those families are also criminals of one kind or another. So it's a dead end street.
That's sad. What is the timetable on the second book, the Cambodian book? When do you expect to have that out?
There's no timetable yet, but for the last 4 or 5 months, I've been doing lots of research. I'm right on the cusp. I'm ready to start writing.
And what about this, the other book you just mentioned on the gang? What is the target audience for that, and who do you plan to market it with?
Well, I think the target audience would be everyday Americans who have no clue, no understanding of the life and times of young people in that situation. But again, there are hundreds of thousands of young people like that all across this country for whom there is no future. The military won't take them. Again, there's no educational opportunity. The only opportunity is pretty much either crime or working at a fast food place. And for young women in the group, quite often they get pregnant at a very early age. Their families then will help as much as they can. There's no prospect for them. There's no man in their life, and so on and so on. It's an oft-repeated pattern.
You mentioned it's a charter work. Will you publish that on demand through Amazon or through someone like that? Or would
no,
be looking
no, I,
for...
I would try. Yeah, I would try to go the route I chose for the memoir that we were talking about. Please Enjoy Your Happiness. Published by Simon & Schuster, great publisher. I would go that route. When I was doing that manuscript, certain friends of mine suggested that I self-publish. But I said, no, I wanted to go the old-fashioned route. I wanted to find an actual agent. I wanted to find an actual real-life publisher. I wanted to have an actual hardcover in my hands. And as the woman I wrote about predicted, now I have a book.
That's terrific. Now the publishing on demand, you can do hardcovers, and of course it's changed. In the old days, the traditional publishers, they used to do great publicity. Now, in most cases, unless you're Stephen King or you're someone else, you're on your own to publicize it. It's difficult. So.
It's difficult. To their credit, Simon & Schuster, did sign up with a service that contacted NPR stations and NPR affiliate networks and stations, and I've done about 20 of those interviews to date with people all across the country. Those have been great. And the publisher also sent me to Orange County, California, to a book lovers conference there. I was the only male author among 14 authors selected. I enjoyed that very much, and I feel that there may be other opportunities, I'm hoping. Also, one wonderful thing was that the actual release date for my book was mid-October, but the publisher stepped up release date to August 2nd because Costco bought many thousands of copies of the book in advance of publication.
That's terrific.
Costco has a monthly magazine, and there's a whole page of it is devoted to what's called Penny's Pick. It's a woman named Penny in Seattle. She picks a book every month, and Costco goes out and buys 10, 20,000 copies. So that immediately launched the book into an unusual spot for a first book by a writer nobody has heard of before. But Penny has had a great track record in picking books that have gone on to do well. And, of course, the hardcover and the Kindle version, and there's also an Audible version now. A British actor named James Langton has done a reading of the book that's available online. The book is doing well, even though there hasn't been the kind of old-fashioned publicity. And the paperback, of course, is yet to appear. So all the thousands of books that have sold so far have been hardcovers, which is nice. Kindle sales are more than 1,000 to date, so that's pretty good. So
that's wonderful.
So far, it's word of mouth. I just had the first foreign sale of the book to a publisher in Bucharest, Romania. And my agent has been in Frankfurt this week at the Frankfurt Book Fair. So who knows what else lies ahead?
It would seem that it would be terrific for Asian publication in Japan or in. It's interesting now. Years ago, we did a computer book for John Wiley, and they came and they said, the Korean firm would like to publish it there and would need your release. And I said, well, how much are we, what's the royalty? And they said, oh, it's only a couple of pennies. And I said, but what happens if we don't sign? And the answer was, they'll publish it anyhow.
Yeah, that could be so.
We could go back and talk about the book until tomorrow morning, and I encourage my listeners, if they don't already have a copy, to get one and to order right after the show. But we will run out of time. What else do you want the listeners to know about this particular book?
Well, of course, it's available at Amazon. Barnes & Noble carries it. The other thing to know about the book is that, again, Simon & Schuster's Touchstone imprint division published the book here in this country, but it also appeared first in London, published there by Macmillan in January.
Okay.
So if your listeners go to Amazon, they'll see two covers. There's a very bright cover showing a woman wearing lipstick on the British version that's available at Amazon, both new and used here in this country. That's the British version. And the American version has a much darker cover of a woman wearing a kimono. And that the American version appeared August 2nd.
So we have the caller on the line from the 614 area code. Hello, caller. Who are you? From the 614 area code? Either the person's hiding, or they're or they're away from the phone. We've already talked about what's next for you, but we've covered a lot of ground tonight. What else would you like the audience to know about Paul Brinkley Rogers?
You know, I think you've covered the ground excellently. I can't really think of anything else to say. Not all of my memoir deals with the friendship that I had with this woman that summer. Some of the book also deals with the way I am now. So if your listeners are curious to know more about me, they can get a pretty good glimpse of what I like to do nowadays, which includes driving Alfa Romeos, Italian sports cars, gardening. I have a big rose garden at my place here in Arizona, travel, and various other things that I'm up to nowadays.
Terrific. Well, thank you, Paul. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you, John. I enjoyed it a lot.
A bit of commercial information. My last column, the Creative Disruption Series, appeared in the Western Guardian, along with columns by ex-congressperson and co-chair of the 9/11 Commission, Lee Hamilton, and then critic John Simon, among others. A publication date for September 29th. It is still online at www.westernguardian.com. Pick up your collector's copy. My books are available at Amazon, and I blog at medium.com. Send any comments about the shows or questions to me at johnnuck13@gmail.com. And in the words of the Mets radio announcer Howie Rose, put them in the book after the Met win, and the season ended very early for the Mets, as we know. I'll be back again next week. And until then, as he used to say in the old neighborhood, see ya.
Thank you, John.
And thank you, Paul. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay, come
on. Good night, everybody. And thank you to my producer, and to the folks, all of them, who want to talk radio. Good night again.